Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Our nation is in danger from an authoritarian president in the White House, aided by a Republican Congress, and elected with support from a hostile foreign power, Russia. Republicans are now waging a systematic political campaign to undermine the FBI, which is investigating Russian interference in our 2016 election and connections to the Trump campaign. You have to wonder, if there's nothing to hide, why are they working so hard to stop the investigation? In addition to this context, we also have the long-standing and increasing problem of big money influencing our government. The big question on the table is, how can we regain our democracy? Here to help us figure out how we can save our democracy is Francis Moore LePay, the author or co-author of 19 books about world hunger, the environment, and living democracy. Her first book was Diet for a Small Planet, published in 1971, with 3 million copies sold. Her most recent book is one of the most vital books of our generation, called Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want, co-authored with Adam Eichen. Her works have been translated into 15 languages, most recently the Chinese publication of Hope's Edge. I met Francis Moore LePay in 1978, and we have shared concerns about hunger and democracy ever since, and I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to interview her about her very important new book, Daring Democracy. Francis Moore LePay, welcome back to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. What a joy to be with you.
I can't tell you how grateful I am that you wrote this book, Daring Democracy, and how exciting it is. I actually had your book with me over the Christmas holidays, and the first time ever, I slipped away from the opening of presents because I was almost done with the book, and I slipped away to finish reading your book. It was awesome.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I'm happy for the chance to share with our listeners what you did. And I'd like the conversation to go kind of in two parts, like the book is. The first part is, in the conversation here, how do we get into this mess? And, you know, what's the underlying conditions that brought us here? And then secondly, and very important, what action can we, the people, take to reclaim our democracy? So let's start with a bit of a dive into your wonderfully clear explanation of how did we get to where we are today.
Thank you. Yes. As you know, Eleanor, I'm a big believer in the power of ideas. And in some ways, we are where we are because of a concerted effort to convince the American people of certain very dangerous ideas that are very harmful to us. And so we start these two chapters, we, that is Adam Eichen and I, and we are two generations apart. What's so thrilling about this book is that a millennial and I got together, and that's quite a story itself, and we agreed on every word in this book.
So that's wonderful.
Something about the 60s generation and the millennials who are very aligned. It's very exciting to me. So Adam and I realized that we had to, you know, you can't get out of any predicament if you don't understand what are the forces getting you there. So we did a deep dive, not in our original research, but relying on great scholars and great journalists. Jane Mayer is one who wrote Dark Money, and that book was incredibly important to many people, including us, to understand how we got into this situation. So we wrote two really tight chapters called Exposing the Roots, and we divided them into two parts. One is manipulating the mindset. This is the power of ideas. And two is rigging the rules, the very deliberate, concerted. This is all on the record, by the way, the public record. We are not conspiratorialists. We're not saying people plotted secretly and we're divining this. No, this is the public record. They intended to be secret, but it's no longer. So having said that, the chapter called Manipulating the Mindset, we anchor in 1971, ironically, the year the Diet for a Small Planet came out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the year that many remember of the 60s generation, that the 60s had accomplished great things in the eyes of most of us, certainly me. I was part of the war on poverty, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the beginning of the environmental movement, the first Earth Day that turned out 20 million people. It was a time of tremendous sense of possibility and a sense that we, the citizens, could get things done. Well, while we saw it very positively, we, meaning those of us, you know, who were involved in community organizing and all, some were very threatened. And among the most threatened, ironically, was the American businessman. And the Chamber of Commerce, that represents the biggest businesses, felt that something, they were losing their grip. And they commissioned a gentleman by the name of Lewis Powell, who was later to be appointed very soon after what I'm about to tell you. He was appointed a Supreme Court justice. And he was a pretty decent guy, as far as I can tell. Really, he had worked for some very good things, like legal services for the poor, et cetera. But he also was really concerned that changes underway were undermining the trust in American business, and that the least respected people were the American businessmen. And he wrote this memo. He was asked by the Chamber of Commerce. It's 34 pages. You can get it online, the Powell memo. And what it turned out to be is a playbook for a strategy to reestablish the dominance of a powerful class of the wealthiest people in our country. And again, it's the power of ideas. I'm not saying he was an evil person, but he really believed that we had to turn over our social outcomes to this automatic law, the quote-unquote, you know, the free market, the free enterprise that would sort out the outcomes and decide winners and losers. And that was the strategy, very much not the public sector at all, that undermining trust in government was what was one of the outcomes. And we also, I can outline some of this mindset, but we actually think, Adam and I, that if Lewis Powell were alive today, he would be horrified by where his playbook has taken us. But you know, he argued that the business interest had to put forward the business point of view in textbooks and graduate programs, we say, from grade school to grad school, through the media, via think tanks. For example, the Heritage Foundation, founded soon thereafter, you know, with this anti-government pro-market point of view, they put forward to the Reagan administration, I believe it was almost 1,300 policies, of which 61% were adopted by the Reagan administration. So very smart use of funding of think tanks to push forward policies from this mindset. And also the media, you know, to deregulate the media so that it would become more and more monopoly, and get rid of the fairness standard, which was in place until the 80s, because the media were seen as a public good in which the public was served by hearing a range of points of view. So media had to present a range. Well, that was done away with. So step after step, there was a degradation of the public arena. And we underscore that part of the strategy was to really undermine, delegitimize government itself. And one of the ways you do that is to make it really ugly and unpleasant. And so we quote this kind of chilling speech by Newt Gingrich, who became Speaker of the House in the 90s. Well, in the 80s, he gave a speech saying that politics had to be carried out with the scale and duration and the savagery of civil war. And Tom DeLay distributed a booklet arguing that, you know, your opponent in politics is not a valued partner in policymaking. He or she is an enemy to be destroyed. Destroy the enemy's fighting power. It was a metaphor of war. So, of course, things got uglier. The filibuster used to make government less and less functional in 2013. The government shutdown, which cost American taxpayer $24 billion. And so there was a delegitimizing that led now to a trust in Congress that has plummeted to 9%. And so this strategy that we call it, we've named it the anti-democracy movement. So it's not just Republicans versus Democrats. It's whether you believe in democracy or not, really. And this movement, led not just by the Republicans, but by more and more people outside of the Republican Party, moving it to the right. Big, big bucks. We talk about a handful, really, of very effective billionaires like the Koch brothers, but also the Schaaf family, the Olin family, and Mercer family, who have this worldview and meet together regularly, and they put money in institutions, whether it's academic or media, et cetera, that will propagate this worldview. So, again, it's not, you know, we're not saying they're a secret cabal. This is now more and more exposed. But I just, before I end this part of my answer, Eleanor, I just want to say that one of the most shocking things to us was that a scholar at Harvard and Columbia wrote a paper about the Koch effect. They call it the paper, and you can get that online as well. They say that now 70% of resources, of political resources on the right, are outside of the Republican Party, or right outside of the party structure. They note that the Koch network is 3.5 times larger than the Republican national and congressional arm. So that's one of the frightening things for us, that this anti-democracy movement is even less accountable than parties and largely invisible. We don't see how this is moving the Republican Party to the right, but it is, because that's where their funding often is coming from.
Right. That is one of the best and most clear explanations I've ever heard of how we got into this mess. So, Frankie, once again, you take your brilliance and apply it to the most important issue of the day and help us all understand how we got here. So thank you for that. And I encourage our listeners to take a look at that memo by Lewis Powell. He did lay out the whole playbook, which now a couple of generations after is really still following the framework that he set out there in a pro-business agenda, but it's been taken to the nth degree now, as you say, by the Koch brothers and other billionaires. And you also go into a good explanation of the four strategies of highly effective billionaires. I love the title of that section of the book.
Yeah.
But you say specific things that are happening, because, as you mentioned, so much of this is invisible to most people. We're not aware of kind of this, you know, talk about an invisible hand, the invisible hand
right,
of the billionaires. That dramatically shape who our candidates are and who gets elected and how votes are taken in Congress and even in our state houses now. And none of this is by accident. It's very highly strategic and well-resourced by the billionaires. So tell our listeners some about these four strategies of highly effective billionaires that are shaping our government.
Well, part of it is under the heading, these strategies are under the heading of rigging the rules. And so part of that then is opening the doors for big money, as we see now with increasing Supreme Court decisions that continue what began in 1976 with Buckley versus Vallejo. But as many of us love to hate, the Citizens United decision and Speech Now in 2010 that led to the super PAC phenomenon, to unleashing independent expenditures and doing so in such a way that it's very, very hard to track this mm-hmm. vast amount of money. And so we have a handful of people. It's about 0.5% of the donors who give about 2/3 of the $6.4 billion spent in the last federal election. $6.4 billion contributed by just this tiny fraction of Americans. So there's this unleashing of enormous amounts of money continuing to climb that is part of the problem. And, of course, that money in politics has many, many downsides of making our representatives accountable, not to the citizen, but to the donor. But it also, you know, one of the things that hit us in writing this is how much of our time of people who work for us, people we hire to sit in Washington and make wise decisions, how much of their time is robbed from us their employers, so to speak, their conscience, us, the citizens, because they spend so much time fundraising, 4 to 5 hours per day. In fact, one of the stories I heard at a conference I went to preparing for this book is that one congressman resigned, ultimately, Steve Israel, because he said the only way to survive this constant demand that he'd get on the phone and make calls and make calls and make calls. It was so humiliating to spend your life that way that he used to duck out to the men's room. That was the only way he could get away from it. And so his staff finally came up and said, "Steve, we really think you should see a doctor. You must have prostate cancer." And with that, he said, "I think it's time I get another job." He couldn't handle it. That was his only escape hatch. And he was outed. And so the point is that there's so many aspects of the corruption built into this. So that's one big piece of it. Another that kind of has gone out of the public eye is the great expansion of lobbyists. Another big whopper for me was that after the Powell memo, just in that first decade after the Powell memo, there was a 14-fold increase in the number of firms that have lobbyists in Washington. And so that's, and of course, many of us have heard the term revolving door, where people leave their position as public servants and go in to serve private interest and as lobbyists. And that, you know, that window, the percentage of people who enter that revolving door has from Congress has greatly increased. It's gone, I believe, from a small fraction to almost half or so. So there's a lobbying is power. But also another really smart strategy of these highly effective billionaires is to reduce the voting power of people to be most hurt by their strategies, that denigrate and defeat the power of unions, for example, and defy, you know, people working to increase the minimum wage, the most basic things like this that they would feel threatening as business people. Well, they set out then to reduce their power. And how do you do that? You make it harder to vote. How do you do that? You insist on voter IDs, which for middle-class people and above, that's very simple. But a lot of poor people rely on public transportation. They have fewer people with driver's licenses and just making time to go to get registered is much tougher if you have two jobs and kids to take care of, etc. So they understand that every time you introduce another barrier, you're selectively hurting lower income people. So the institution of voter ID is another piece of this, now in dozens of states. Another piece is denying felons who have paid their time and they have come back to society, and by all rights, we want to integrate them back in so that their dignity can be restored and they can contribute. What happens in several states, they're denied the right to vote. So that's another strategy because, again, they are people most likely to be hurt by the strategies of highly effective billionaires. So this reducing the voting power of people is another strategy. And then there's a strategy we call just wipe out local democracy by what's called preemption. And we highlight the now infamous example of Flint, Michigan, Detroit, Michigan, where the local government was wiped out. And one of the consequences of the emergency manager was the terrible lead in water crisis that damaged so many lives and still has not been sorted out effectively. So, and then, you know, a piece of this big money dimension, let me just say, another shocker for me is the use of the courts, because until I did the research for this book, I kind of thought naively that court cases sort of that rise to the top do so kind of spontaneously because they're inherently so valuable. But what we learned is that take Citizens United, which 80% of us say we don't approve of. That was the 2010 decision that unleashed unlimited corporate and union money, independent spending in elections that gave birth to the super PAC phenomenon. Well, that actually came to be because of the DeVos family. DeVos family, you may have heard that name now, Betsy DeVos, she is now Secretary of Agriculture. Her family wealth is from
education.
Amway. Yeah. What did I say?
Agriculture.
Sorry. Yes. Yep. Sorry. Thank you for that correction. I meant to say education. I guess I'm still stuck back in my food world.
Right, exactly.
Oh, dear. Thank you for that. Yes. So her family's wealth is from Amway. Now, Amway is a distributed sales scheme that is incredibly successful, particularly in the Midwest. This very wealthy family then chose to support the Madison Center, a lawyer there, James Bopp, who picked this particular case to just push and push and push at every level and keep appealing it and keep appealing it until it got to the Supreme Court, the Citizens United decision. So even there, you know, behind it all was a very, very wealthy family. One of the effective strategies of these billionaires was to use the courts in this very deliberate way.
Right, exactly. So you've done a fabulous job of laying out the problem we have, and now I hope our listeners are not too depressed hearing all of this, and I'm sure they know many pieces of it, if not the whole thing, but you say it so incredibly well. But we do have hope, and there are things we can do and that people are doing. So what do you recommend? How do we overcome our sense of powerless to change it? Because we're not billionaires. How are we going to combat these billionaires who have such a grip on our government? How do we overcome powerlessness?
Well, the exciting thing for me right now is that I feel for the first time in my entire life, there is really a democracy movement. And this is the pathway that people are getting it from the Sierra Club to NAACP to the labor movement. People are understanding that unless we tackle the fundamentals and reclaim the fundamentals of our democracy through our own citizen action and educating our neighbors, that we can't solve these other passions of ours about climate change or ending poverty or fair wages for fair work. So for the first time in my life, I am actually thrilled about what's happening. I marched with Democracy Spring, as you know, in 2016. I saw you there, Eleanor. And we marched for democracy reforms. And it was all across the spectrum of regular people across all these issues. And we were willing to sit in. 1,300 people arrested on the Capitol steps, one of the biggest demonstrations there ever. And so what gives me hope is this: We're getting it. We've got to go to democracy reforms. And by democracy reforms, I mean reforms like public financing, which exist in the majority of world's democracies, that the public understands that if private companies and private individuals fund elections, that we won't have a democracy because it will be the opposite, responding to private interests. So we tell the story of how this democracy movement is now building from the bottom up, from the cities, the counties, and the state level. We tell story after story. And remember that, you know, until the civil rights movement actually succeeded in the civil rights and voting rights, people were never really convinced it would work. Until it happened, we didn't know. And the same is about the women's movement. Every great movement that has opened up our democracy, that's furthered our sense of pride in our country, you know, it wasn't known, it wasn't that it could happen until it did happen. And so one of our mottos, in fact, I'm looking at it in my wall of my office, an intern painted it for me. One of our mottos is, it's not possible to know what's possible. And that is the most freeing insight of my life, that we don't have to be optimists, and certainly pessimism is not helpful, but we don't have to be, we don't have to have certainty. This is the key to understanding our book, Daring Democracy, that human beings have shown throughout history that it isn't the magnitude of a challenge that crushes us, it's feeling futile, as you put it, powerless. And as long as we feel that something is possible and that there's a place for us in it and that it's essential, then we can stand up. And human beings we, without feeling powerful, we shrivel and we die earlier. Honestly, it's not good mm-hmm. for our health. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence for that, right?
Right.
That we weren't born to be, you know, we didn't evolve to be couch potatoes and whiners and depressed. And yet I just heard this morning on the radio that 1 in 5 of us in America is now suffering an anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced that the way to get through the way to enrich our lives, and this is the next to the last chapter in our book, where, because I want to get into the real practical stories, but I want to say, too, that in these stories, we describe what we call the thrill of democracy, that feeling of that we can connect with strangers and find this common purpose, and that we can find that we're more courageous than we thought, and we can do it in community, and that we can feel that we're powerless, powerful, maybe not even that we can create some ultimate solution in our lifetime, but we can experience that progress. And that's what it takes. We don't have to feel that we can have a final answer, because, of course, democracy is always a journey. So this is the theme of our book, that democracy is not some dull duty, you know, some spinach we have to slog down to get our yummy dessert of sugary sweets, right? No, no, no.
Right.
It's actually the thrill. It's the good stuff. It's what we all want, that feeling that we count and that we can come together with others and feel triumphant. And so take the state of Maine. I love to tell this story because in 1996, they wanted to get money out of politics in Maine. And so they wanted to put an initiative on the ballot for public finance of elections, so that if you wanted to run for office, you could get a small amount from a certain number of people to show that you're a viable candidate, and then you qualify for public financing and you could run a decent campaign. And they tried to find a polling company that would poll it to see how much support it had. And they refused. They said, it's unethical. We can't poll this question because it definitely can't succeed and it would be a waste of your money. And then they won. They won. And in 2000, my friend Deb Simpson, who was a waitress in Auburn, Maine, she ran for office and won and was reelected 4 times and was a stellar legislator, sitting on committees in the legislature, et cetera. So not that anything is perfect, and they've had big setbacks in Maine, but they've moved forward as well. And so I could go on telling specific stories from the book if you'd like me to do that, or you let me know where you'd like me to go.
Yeah, well, I love the story about Maine. I was going to ask you about that. It's about big money out, citizens in, how we can replace big money with people power, exactly how you're saying, with this public financing. So I love the examples you give in the book. People say, oh, well, what can we do? You've got, like, your book is chock-a-block full of not only what we can do, what people are already doing. So the public financing, for example, is not just Maine, but it's in other states like Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the idea about having greater transparency of the funds, like the Massachusetts law, my home state, requiring funders of political ads to take responsibility for the message. What do you see happening, for example, when it's almost like you could take all the strategies of what the highly effective billionaires are doing and just kind of do the complete opposite, and we'll probably be heading in the right direction.
Exactly.
And in that vein, how would you reduce lobbyist power? Because we see them crawling all over Washington, D.C. They're everywhere. And this fundraiser's up the wazoo, morning, noon, and night, that whole money piece. How do we reduce the power of lobbyists?
Oh, boy. That's a really tough one. Well, one is just learning this intense making visible, exposing. I mean, I think that's so powerful that one of the stories we tell in the book is about this organization, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. A lot of people know that acronym, but don't know how they work, that they actually go beyond the lobby and they get in and sit down with the state legislators, for example, and help write the laws. And they have these model laws that have been passed, equivalent about 3 for each state in the union. It's quite astonishing. And they're all along these lines of restricting voting, for example, and preemption taking over, you know, with the city manager and that sort of thing. So that I think the one key is just really shining the light on these devious strategies that are so anti-democratic, and making sure that your legislature does not allow a place for corporate interest to be sitting at the drafting table. And so I think Common Cause and many of the groups that are in our book, as well as, let me underscore here, that we're creating an online hub called Field Guide to the Democracy Movement. And there is a map that's going live this weekend, a map that will be going live where you can mouse over each state and see wherever you live what are the initiatives happening that have to do with just what I'm saying, transparency. For example, California just passed a great disclose law that actually requires, you mentioned earlier, but this requires that the three top funders for an ad be listed right at the top, so you know who's funding whatever you're seeing before you even read it. So you can find out what's happening in your own city and state and take part in that, because the other thing on this, on the Steel Guide, and we're going to make it easier and easier for people to search on it, but you can search through the organizations that are working on all of these issues and find those that most tickle your fancy in terms of what issues that you can get engaged in. So I think part of it is exposing the power of lobbyists so that legislators are held accountable for the amount of influence and time they spend, and also coming up as citizen lobbyists so that we are countering that power of private interest through our own calls, our own visits to legislators. I know the Citizens Climate Lobby has become famous for their energy for that kind of approach of the citizens' lobby. And I think that all, you know, that fundamentally, too, it comes back to the counter to lobbyist influence is voter influence. When if we're not voting, if our votes are being suppressed, votes of especially low-income people most hurt by these anti-democratic strategies, that all we're doing to get more people out to vote, for example, through automatic voter registration, which began in Oregon in the year 2015, and already nine other states and District of Columbia passed it, so things can happen very fast. I mean, all those ways in which we are increasing the capacity of people to vote and getting the vote out can help counter the damage that lobbyists can do, because we are then have more people holding legislators accountable to our interests. So there's not one pathway here, because this has grown over, you know, all these decades. But I think that, you know, that old saying, and I'm probably going to mangle, but, you know, that what sunlight is the best disinfectant, that
right.
Only with this citizens movement, a democracy movement, then do we start holding our elected officials accountable to us. Fundamentally, that's the lobbyists take over if we're not there, right?
Right.
So,
well,
that's
and
it.
I've worked on quite a number of campaigns. I've actually been campaign manager several times for some great candidates. And what I like to remind people of when they're feeling powerless in the face of the billionaires is say, look, there's a lot more of us than there are of them. And the way that the billionaires can win with their pro-big business agenda is if we feel powerless and stay home. But once we take action and we register to vote, we help other people register to vote, and we get to the polls, we have the power, really. And they're counting on us not being able to exercise our power for them to thrive with their pro-corporate agenda. But when you think about it from a candidate's point of view, that really what does the candidate want? They want to win the election. And right now, they're feeling the way they can win is by having a lot of money and using it for the media and everything else. But really, what we have is the votes. And they want the money to get the votes. But we got the votes. So let's make it clear that we're going to use our votes to elect people who are really there to help the average American and not to be carrying the water for big business.
Right, right. And, you know, you think about it, we can feel pretty grim about the state of our democracy now. We should. I mean, we should be very disturbed and motivated to be part of this glorious movement. And I want people to go see our field guide and how much is going on. And also recognize, say, gerrymandering. Even the word gerrymandering, I sense a year ago or 2 years ago, was not really something that people were looking at and understanding how damaging this partisan gerrymandering is. And now it's going to the Supreme Court because it was such an extreme case in Wisconsin that led to the Democrats to lose seats, even though they had the majority of votes. So gerrymandering, I think we can really say that some states have really stepped up, like California. We described their independent commission and how carefully they have like 8 different steps that the commission goes through to try to be sure to have a nonpartisan committee that sets district lines so they can't be gerrymandered to deny people the vote. And actually, somebody who interviewed us on our book tour went to one of the California commission hearings on the redistricting in his area, and the commission listened to the citizens and his own suggestion on how something could be drawn better. And they had technicians there who drew the picture as he was suggesting would make it more fair, and they ended up going along with the citizens' view. So some states, also New York, we highlight this incredible story about how Common Cause created a participatory, you know, process for drawing district lines, and they teamed up with Newsday on Long Island, and they created such a fair and such a transparent process that the state ended up going along with it as something that made a lot of sense. So there's so many examples that we don't hear about because too often we just hear the bad news.
That's exactly right. And gerrymandering, for our listeners who aren't familiar with the term, is basically how the lines are drawn for a district, whether it be for a state seat or for a federal seat. And often those lines are drawn by political people in a back room somewhere. But as you say, it's now become, in many places, a more transparent process, and that, in fact, you talk about 13 states have commissions now that are independent of the legislatures, so that, you know, you have a more independent process, and it's not totally captured by the partisans using it as a weapon of political warfare, but just making sensible lines. And, you know, so we can and have made progress on fair districting lines.
Right. I mean, yes, absolutely. And now, because of a case in Wisconsin, it will go to the Supreme Court, I believe, this spring. And hopefully the court, we'll see what happens, could judge that this kind of partisan gerrymandering actually denies us, you know, the equal voice in our democracy. So we shall see. But in any case, I think there is enough, I mean, there is more and more of exactly what you described, citizens stepping up to create independent commissions. And I know there's a form of an agency in Iowa that has worked out a way that has gotten a lot of public support, even though it's not independent, that it's bipartisan, and people have thought that it's quite fair. So there's a lot of ways to do this. But that's another key aspect of democracy. And one of the things we want to point out here that we learned that we were surprised by is, but it makes perfect sense, is that now the capacity to manipulate data and to do these modeling, computer models of how to draw the lines to ensure that your party will be reelected has become so much more sophisticated with this big data approach and computer modeling that I don't begin to understand, we've kind of entered a new level of sophistication of how to manipulate the maps, and that's why we have to take hold of this and do it in a totally different and fair and transparent way.
Exactly. And you talked about the importance of defending voting rights, and you have some great stories in your book about how we can repeal the voter identification laws. We can expand early voting. We can have same-day voter registration so that on election day you can go to the polls and just sign up right there. And we have some states where there's actually automatic voter registration. You know, you turn 18 and now you're able to vote in Oregon and now seven more states. So there's a lot that's happening where people are working to defend and expand voting rights.
Absolutely. And it does, it is shown truly to make a difference. And Massachusetts, actually, there was a lobbying day yesterday for automatic voter registration. I'd wanted to go, and but I'll have another opportunity. We've testified once about it, but Massachusetts hopefully will take the lead in passing that, because we think of ourselves as being leaders, but we're not in this regard yet. You know, another, you know, in terms of what makes elections fair, we haven't mentioned, for example, the city, public finance at the city level. One of the things I was so impressed with in this book is the New York City Council, that it was one of the first to introduce public financing for, it was a matching system for running for city council. And over, you know, now a couple decades, that now the city council truly represents the diversity of the city. It's majority, majority people of color. And I think that is just such a symbol of the success of what people can do when they take the financing of elections seriously. So I really salute New York City.
Fantastic. And, you know, these are all great individual initiatives, and there's been, as you talk about, some really incredible successes with these around the country. They're just kind of, for some reason, when we get the successes, they're not quite so visible. They're not being really covered in the media, but you put it all together so beautifully in your book on Daring Democracy. You also talk about, beyond an individual initiative like defending our voting rights, that each of these really requires organizing and political power to make the changes we need. And you talk about not just individual initiatives passing, but really the emergence in the United States of a democracy movement. And you talk about Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening, the idea that there's a movement of movements, that no matter what issue you care about, we need to have democracy to make progress on that issue. So talk a little bit about kind of what you see as the democracy movement emerging in the United States right now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Eleanor. Well, if you go to the fieldguidefordemocracy.org, fieldguidedemocracy.org, the co-sponsor of that, still in progress, you know, we're still working on it and will forever, but you can at least there's a beginning of this exciting movement visible. Well, the other co-sponsor with us, we asked Democracy Initiative to be part of this great online hub. And the reason we asked them is they represent now, they represent 30 million 34 million people, and I believe it's 63 organizations, that's it, across labor, across the environment, NAACP, and on. And so they then worked together I went to their annual meeting, and it was so stirring. And this Democracy Initiative then helps this large, you know, fusion of organizations target campaigns in specific states and counties to give more oomph to the local effort. So it's a brilliant way. And, of course, the Internet aids this because it can help people stay focused and feel that connection with each other. So the Democracy Initiative has given me a lot of hope. And another example at the state level is what many call fusion politics in North Carolina. North Carolina was, you know, once a leading state in many ways in social measures, and then it had a big setback as a Koch-connected party entered that state. Art Pope, his name, and big money helped move it in a very far, you know, anti-democracy direction. And then this fusion movement of citizens came together with a 14-point agenda across everything from minimum wage to health care to racial justice and criminal justice reform. And this 14-point agenda then gathered 200 organizations. This is great movement of movements. 200 organizations with 2 million North Carolinians behind it. They had sit-ins every Monday. It was called Moral Mondays. It is called Moral Mondays, and the first year of their sit-ins, 900 people were willing to risk arrest for these democracy reforms, such as, ending voter suppression, getting rid of voter ID laws and that sort of thing, and restoring polling stations and early voting and all of that. So here is a state-level movement of movements that, to me, is just so inspiring, and that is now inspiring other states to take that same approach of bringing people together across issues in one movement. So this, they call it fusion politics in North Carolina. So there's another, you know, I encourage anyone to follow that movement for inspiration and to see what, through our map, maybe there's something in your state you can see that is happening along those lines or a group that is focused on one of these voting rights questions or public financing, something dearest to your heart where you are. And then consider bringing in groups that aren't necessarily headlined by, you know, democracy reforms, but might want to lend their support to a democracy reform. I mean, that is the key when we all get it, that democracy is the basis of a functional society.
Right. And you're talking about this wonderful field guide you put together, the Field Guide to the Democracy Movement. And how can our listeners access that on the Internet?
Well, if you just type in fieldguidetodemocracy.org, you will find it. I don't. And the other thing is through our website, smallplanet.org. But Field Guide to Democracy is really, fieldguidetodemocracy.org is all you have to remember. I think we've got another URL, it's harder for me to remember, fg2d.org, fg2d.org. It's a lot shorter. But all you have to remember is Field Guide to Democracy.
Well, that's a great resource to have, and I encourage our listeners to go check out that Field Guide to the Democracy Movement, because there's so much going on, and be a way for you to figure out kind of what's happening in your area that you can connect in with. And there's so much movement now. We've got the Women's March that happened, which is the largest mobilization of citizens in the world. Was the day after Trump was inaugurated president, and women and men took to the streets the next day. There were like 3 million people worldwide, and we just had the annual Women's March this past weekend. So there's that whole set of groups that are active locally. We've got the Indivisible group. You know, tell people about the Indivisible program and why that is important.
Yeah, well, one of the most inspiring things to me was just right after the election, one couple, as I understand it, and their friends put out this call for people to get together and have an amazing website now and a guide for action. Just all you have to remember is Indivisible. In a couple of weeks, they're coming here to Boston. I get to meet the founders, I hope. But that's another great way to connect wherever you are with other people who are interested in not just resisting, but in taking positive action. So between, I think, Indivisible is a way to look up and hook up with people locally and our field guide to tie you into the actual movement groups and issues, their background primers so you can learn about all this stuff. And so I think those, you know, the combo sort of our field guide and the Indivisible tool are really helpful. And I'll know, of course, a lot more after I hear this founder of Indivisible speak, but I was in awe of their initiative and how it just took off.
Yeah, it's been absolutely phenomenal. And I recently interviewed some of the people in Indivisible, and really it came sprang out of people who were working as staff in Congress, and they saw how effective the right-wing Tea Party activists were in gumming up the works, even though they were in the minority. And they noted what the tactics were that were effective about stopping bad stuff from happening. And they just turned it around and said, you know, as people who work in Congress, we can tell you if you want to have an impact, here's what you do. And they laid it out very simply in the Indivisible Guide, which is the best guide to impacting Congress that I've ever seen. And it's now we've got groups working in every congressional district all across the country. Individual groups get together regularly and figure out, you know, what's the priority of the week and what's most important to take action on. And it was Indivisible was instrumental in stopping the assault to really attack and undermine Obamacare, you know, the health care, and also Medicaid. So it's been a very effective group. So you talk about that in your book. And also you talk about organizations which get together, the Democracy Initiative with the some unlikely suspects. You get the Sierra Club with the Communication Workers of America Union, the NAACP, and Greenpeace all coming together to support electoral reform. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that's what, you know, they are our partners. That I mentioned on the field guide. They we reached out to them because they're the embodiment in a sense of the movement of movement. So they were really excited to work with us on this field guide, and so we're unveiling it at a conference this weekend in New Orleans with a new map that hasn't really gone up yet. It's going to go up. Let's see, on Saturday, I guess, it goes live, this much more developed map where you can mouse over the states. So I should warn listeners that, it's not that filled out now, but it's going to take a huge leap on the weekend where we unveil it at this conference called Unrig the System that was been pulled together by Represent Us in Northampton, Massachusetts. So, yes, the Democracy Initiative is the, as you say, the embodiment of this approach, because we're very unlikely partners on there. And already 63 organizations representing 30 to 40 million people. So that's been hugely
One of the things that's been under the radar, as you talk about in the 2016 election, we all know the bad news about Trump in the White House and the Republicans controlling the House and the Senate and Congress. But on the brighter side, there were 17 ballot initiatives across the country, and 14 of the 17 ballot initiatives actually passed. So when we get organized, we can win.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. That's one of the things I always feel like I should start with, because you know, that on that night, a lot of people were so shocked and depressed and did not realize that, you know, for example, Alaska implemented automatic voter registration, you know, which we've been saying is such an important piece of this. And Berkeley, California, with 65% of the vote, enacted public financing. And, you know, there were some really amazing things, including South Dakota. South Dakota has voted Republican in 80% of every election in its whole lifetime as a state. And yet, that same night, they passed an initiative that was a sweeping anti-corruption act that had that has in it just so many of these protections. Unfortunately, the legislature blocked it from implementation, but the people of that state are not giving up. And what's so important to me is that they passed it with a solid majority. And so even though it got blocked for now, I think it's another very, very helpful, initiative that was started by the citizens there. Actually, Represent Us, the organization that is behind this conference this weekend, was the group that initiated local, you know, motivated local people, got it going with this Anti-Corruption Act that passed.
Yep. Well, we're just about out of time here. I want to let our listeners know to learn more about Frances Moore LePage's work. Check out her website, smallplanet.org, and connect with another group to her Field Guide to the Democracy Movement. That's all the time we have. Frances Moore LePage, thank you so much for being with us today.
What a wonderful opportunity, and so happy to reconnect with you.